Today's broadcast on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Franklin Travel, presenting the 7th Masterpiece and More Tour, leaving September 24th for England and France. The 16-day WILL benefit will visit the French countryside and includes live theater and symphony performances. Good morning. Welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad you can be listening. We'll be talking in this part of the show about the Middle East, concentrating on, I suppose, on three areas: on the current round of the Middle East peace talks, on U.S.-Israeli relations, and also the possibility, possible outcomes of elections scheduled in for June for Israel. We have as our guest this morning John Rothman. He's a political and foreign policy consultant who specializes in the United States, the Middle East, and also Soviet affairs. Among his activity, a lot of traveling, a lot of lecturing. He's spoken on a great number of college and university campuses throughout this country and also Canada and Israel. He served on the faculty of the University of San Francisco, was a longtime member of the San Francisco Jewish Community Relations Council and a number of other kind of organizations. He has been with us before. This is his second visit on the program. A number of years ago, he was in the area and was here again. And we thought it'd be a good opportunity to talk with him once again. As we do talk, you should feel free to pick up the telephone and call in if you have comments or questions. Our telephone number here locally is 333-WILL, also toll-free 800-222-WILL. Thank you very much for being with us again.
David, it's a pleasure to be back. Lovely to see you. You look younger than ever.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll let that one pass. We just wrapped up the most current round of the peace negotiations in the Middle East, and we seem to be at an impasse, and it seems to be sort of the same impasse that we've been at before, as both sides, the Palestinians and the Israelis, have presented each other with their vision of the territories. On the Palestinian side, they would like to have elections, and they would like to have Israeli troops leave. And the Israelis have continued to maintain, while they would give the Palestinians authority to oversee a number of aspects of life in the territory, that they do not want to see elections for some kind of overarching Palestinian authority happen, and would like to continue to hold the responsibility for maintaining security. And they say that the Palestinian plan, what it amounts to, is the beginnings of an independent Palestinian state, which is what the Palestinians have said that they want. There doesn't seem to be a great deal of room for negotiation in between those two points. Where do they go from there?
I guess we can start by saying that things have improved dramatically since last I was here in 1989. When I say improvement, I think it's important to consider where we've come since then. If I had suggested in 1989 that there would be a peace conference and that sitting around the table would be all of the adversaries of Israel, the Israelis, and representatives of the Palestinian people, I think most people would have said it was very far-fetched. And the reality is that what we saw in Madrid just a few brief months ago was a breakthrough of monumental import, where you saw Arab and Israeli leaders talking with each other. And I want to draw a difference between talking at each other, or talking to each other, and talking with each other. They really are in dialogue now. Much of what happens in private, but it's very important. Now, there is no doubt that there is an impasse. There is an impasse on several levels of the peace discussions. There is an impasse between Israel and Syria over the question of regional talks, including talks about water, which are central to the region and central to the question of the Golan Heights. Two of the headwaters of the Jordan River, two of the three headwaters, are located in the Golan Heights. The Syrians really can't expect territorial compromise on the Golan unless there are discussions about the issue of water, yet the Syrians refuse to participate in the water conference. No doubt there is an impasse between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Your summary is, I think, quite apt, and that is that the Israelis insist, for their security concerns, on military control of the territories. They are willing to go with autonomy elections, that is to say, for Palestinians to hold elections to elect their own authority, but that authority's control would be severely limited. In fact, the Israelis view autonomy as autonomy. The Palestinians, who for years rejected autonomy, now say that they view autonomy as a first step towards statehood. I think in the Israeli mind, there is an image. The image is of Palestinians standing on the rooftops as Scud missiles hit Tel Aviv, cheering. There is the realization that had Yasser Arafat had a state, the Scud missiles would not have flown 250 miles from Iraq to hit Tel Aviv with relative imprecision, doing great damage, but would have in fact been able to be launched from 10 or 12 miles away from Tel Aviv. There is a real feeling in Israel of insecurity. Perhaps the best line of all was articulated by Moshe Aarons, the current defense minister of Israel, who said the Middle East is not the Middle West. There are not vast expanses of territory. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest to you that while there is an impasse, there is something else that is critical, and that is the talks are continuing. Israelis and Palestinians are talking not only in the context of the discussions themselves, but behind the scenes. There are ongoing discussions between the Israelis and the Syrians, Israelis and Jordanians, Israelis and Egyptians. I think it was very encouraging that the Saudis sent an observer, as did a number of the Gulf states, to send observers to the conference. I think it was very useful and important. Are we on the verge of a breakthrough in terms of peace? I think what we are doing is making step-by-step progress, and that is an important realization. Now, are the talks going to bring immediate results? The answer is we're on hold now because of elections, which will be held in Israel on June 23rd. The Israelis have some very tough decisions to make. This will be an election that will be based primarily on foreign policy issues, in contrast to, say, the election of 1984, when the real issue was double-digit inflation and the question of the economy. And you can proceed now with some of those questions about the elections.
Well, yes, let me ask you about that, because I think there certainly is a lot of interest focused on the elections, in part, I suppose, because Mr. Rabin seems now to have taken over the leadership of the Labor Party, and from Shimon Peres. And some people are suggesting that perhaps he might have the right combination of qualities, being sort of uniquely conservative on some things and liberal on some other things, that it's possible that he might be the man to beat Mr. Shamir.
Well, there's no doubt that the Labor Party selected Rabin because they viewed him as a stronger candidate than Mr. Peres. But I want to emphasize there are points of similarity between Likud and Labor that are important for us to understand. Both Likud and Labor believe Jerusalem must remain the united, undivided capital of Israel. Both Likud and Labor reject the possibility of the creation of a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza. Both Likud and Labor oppose discussions with the PLO, a terrorist organization committed to the destruction of Israel. Both Labor and the Likud believe that Jewish settlements in the territories are legal. There is a difference between the two of them in that Likud says we need to settle the whole land of Israel, meaning everywhere, including heavily populated Arab areas, while Labor is committed to settlement in three areas: Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and the Jordan River Valley. I'd hasten to point out that 90% of the Jewish settlers live in those three areas. So there is not a substantial difference between Labor and Likud. And finally, that both are committed to a strong alliance with the United States. So there are broad consensus issues which the overwhelming majority of people in Israel concur upon. I can't tell you who will win the June 23rd election. I can tell you the polls show it to be a very close election. There are some who believe a national unity government may emerge. There are 120 members of the Israeli parliament. To form a government, you need 61 seats. No political party has ever won 61 seats. Every government of Israel has been a coalition government. You will recall that there was a national unity government in Israel from 1984 to 1990, that Mr. Rabin served as defense minister in that government, while Mr. Peres and Mr. Shamir alternated the position of prime minister. I think that that the talks will probably, in terms of peace talks, will be on hold until after the Israeli election. In fact, the Syrians have suggested that there be a delay in renewal of talks until the new government is formed. That's probably a good idea. I don't know that it's reasonable to expect a nation that is in the midst of active electioneering to be able to make any kind of decisive decision. But make no mistake, the people of Israel are having a referendum on foreign policy, and the decisions that they make about the directions they choose to take will be critical in the formulation of Israel's position on peace.
So you're talking about the fact that there are areas where there is agreement between Likud and Labor. What are the areas where they differ? How is it that Israeli voters are going to make their decision based on what sort of issue?
Well, on foreign policy, I think one of the key things is Likud is opposed to land for peace. Likud believes that the whole land of Israel should remain under Israeli sovereignty. Labor believes in a land for peace formula. The question you have to pose is what land, for what peace, and to whom? Yitzhak Rabin will run on a platform advocating a Jordanian option. That is to say, that Israel and Jordan should cut some sort of deal. Now, I know that on the campus today, I believe at 3 o'clock, or 3 or 4 o'clock, the Jordanian representative at the talks in Madrid will be speaking on campus, and I hope
he's going to be here tomorrow.
Oh, he's going to be here tomorrow. Great. Yeah. And you will be able to ask him, and I hope you do ask him directly, what the implications in his mind would be of a Rabin victory. Because if Rabin wins, he's going to try to convince King Hussein, the ruler of Jordan, to enter into a relationship with Israel to secure some sort of accord. Now, Shimon Peres tried that during his 2 years as prime minister. He and King Hussein had 22 separate secret meetings. They're so secret, we know exactly how many meetings they had. They were unable to come to any kind of resolution. So I think the real bottom line question for the interview tomorrow will be, what if Rabin wins? What if Rabin offers the Jordanians some sort of an accommodation? Where does that leave the Palestinians? The main theme that the Jordanian representative struck in Madrid was a theme that Jordan is not Palestine. As you understand, 80% of the land area of Palestine under the old British mandate is today Jordan. About 15% is now Israel. 5% is in dispute in terms of territory. 70% of the population of Jordan are Palestinians. Half of the Palestinians in the world are Jordanian citizens. And the Jordanians are very sensitive to the fact that they are Jordanians. They are not Palestinians. And yet there is no doubt that the Jordan is Palestine question is one which deeply concerns the Jordanians. And one of the things I think you can logically say in terms of differences between Likud and Labor is that Labor really wants to deal with King Hussein. They want to strike a deal with Hussein. The Likud is committed to making a deal with Hussein if they can, but they also believe that perhaps the theme of Jordan is Palestine is not a bad one to strike in terms of giving the Palestinians a place of their own. Mm-hmm. So there are differences on foreign policy. The other major difference, of course, is that the Labor Party would not have Jewish settlements in major populated Arab areas. And that is a substantial difference from the Likud, although the number of settlers settling in heavily populated Arab areas is so insignificant that it's really not the problem.
Well, let me ask you further about this deal that you're talking about. Labor being interested in doing with King Hussein. Are we talking about removing the Palestinians from the territories and having them move to Jordan? We're talking about redrawing the border? And
I'll tell you what the deal is. You understand that there is a joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation.
Yeah.
And that even in the 1980s, particularly in 1985, King Hussein and Yasser Arafat signed an agreement that they subsequently tore up for a joint administration, essentially, a joint relationship. I think that Rabin views the Jordanian regime as more trustworthy as a military force than a potential Palestinian military force. So a combination of Jordanians and Palestinians together is a more acceptable formula. But it involves directly a role for King Hussein. I have to tell you that I really believe that if a Palestinian state were created, the first target of such a state would not be Israel. The first target would be King Hussein. And I think that's a concern of Hussein's that is an underlying problem. He went through Black September of 1970 when the Palestinians tried to remove him from power. And, of course, his relationship with Yasser Arafat has been less than satisfactory over the years. In fact, I remember in 1986, King Hussein took to the airwaves and delivered a 3.5-hour diatribe against the PLO and Yasser Arafat as being completely untrustworthy. Things change and relationships change, but there's no doubt that the Jordanians are concerned about that issue. So I think Labor's point is, let's get the Palestinians and the Jordanians together and let's cut a deal, giving the Palestinians a real relationship with Jordan as I say, the question for Labor is what land, for what peace, and to whom? Labor is not prepared to give land to Yasser Arafat. It is prepared to return land to Jordan.
We're talking this morning with John Rothman. He is a lecturer and consultant who specializes in, among other things, Middle Eastern affairs. He's visiting here in Champaign-Urbana. Good enough to come over and spend some time with us talking about the Middle East. If you have questions or comments, pick up the telephone, call 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Let me ask you one further question about the elections, and I don't know if this gets too finely into detail about Israeli politics. But apparently, on Sunday, I believe this was, the Central Committee of Likud dropped the foreign minister, Mr. Levy, Davi Levy, from the number two spot on the party's list. And I guess the thing that's important about that is that it implies some sort of order of succession after Mr. Shamir. So they took Levy out, and they put him down to number four, putting him behind Moshe Aarons, the defense minister, and Ariel Sharon, the housing minister. And apparently Mr. Levy was rather upset about it. And there seemed to be some suggestion in stories that I've read about is that he could withdraw his support from Likud. And if he decided that he was going to support Yitzhak Rabin, that maybe that would increase his chances of victory. How do we sort all that out?
I don't think that's likely. I think Levy is firmly wedded to the Likud. He may have had a setback in this particular situation, but things can turn. Mr. Shamir got us his number two, the man he wanted, Moshe Aarons. Aarons is very much the model of Shamir. They're a team. They work very well together. There are some people who think that Aarons is the logical successor to Shamir. Aarons is the former foreign minister and current defense minister of Israel, former Israeli ambassador to the United States, a very articulate, solid fellow, and in the mainstream of Likud. Then there's Arik Sharon, about whom we say he's like a bull who carries with him his own china shop. Arik Sharon has a substantial amount of support in the Likud, but not enough to become party leader. The Begin Shamir wing would absolutely oppose his elevation. And he does represent the right of the Likud, and he was able to come in third because he has a substantial following, not enough to come in one or two. David Levy's problem really has been that people don't view him as a creditable candidate for prime minister. They think he's very able as housing minister, that he's done an adequate job as foreign minister, but he has some disadvantages. He doesn't speak English. He has not been viewed as a particularly active person in terms of the field of foreign affairs. So I think really what this demonstrated was that while Levy is firmly in the Likud upper list and is viewed more as a to the left in the Likud, that he is not viewed as a potential successor. What this means is that the top five candidates, six candidates, are really the key people. Aarons, who came in number two, Benjamin Netanyahu, who came in number five, and Benjamin Begin, Benny Begin, the son of former Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who came in number six. And if I were going to be a prognosticator, I would say that the next prime minister after Shamir, if the Likud were to win, would either be Aarons or Benny Begin. And that in all likelihood, Netanyahu, being that high on the list, is almost a certainty, if the Likud forms a government, to be foreign minister, if not this time, then next time.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with somebody. We have a caller here on our toll-free line. Let's talk with him. Hello.
Hello. I'm interested, I guess what I'd call your methodology. I'm interested in how you make decisions on certain interpretations of people's moves over there in the Middle East. Particularly, you were just talking about Mr. Levy, and David asked you a question about him, and you said, no, you didn't think so. Then you gave out, you know, the reasons why. I'm interested in what newspapers you read, what journals or magazines, whether they're in English or Arabic or French in particular. What kind of connections you have, and how you go about summing up these things, other than, you know, the rest of us can read the newspapers and we get facts, more or less, but to see somebody who has his fingertips on it all, I'd like to know something about that aspect of how you go about doing your job. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My job is to be an analyst. That means that I take information, I try to analyze it very carefully. I read a broad range of journals, everything from the Jerusalem Post to the Journal of Palestine Studies. I read all of the major American newspapers and magazines. I do read some foreign publications. I try to listen to the news on an hourly basis. Walked into the studio here in 1101. I was saying, stop, we got to listen to the news. I try to keep up on things, but I think it's like anything. If you're interested in a subject, and you have a working knowledge of a subject, and you develop any proficiency in a subject, it doesn't mean your analysis is always right. Believe me, I'm not always right, sometimes wrong. But what you try to do is to learn from your experience. So in my mind, there is one other thing that you can do that to me is very useful, and that is I think it's very useful to visit an area that you're particularly interested in. I spend a good deal of time in the Middle East. I visit Israel and the Arab world on a fairly regular basis. I try to get there at least once a year. And I go to hear lectures. I go to listen to other people when they speak. I deeply regret that I'm not going to be here in Champaign-Urbana this afternoon to hear the Jordanian representative at the peace talks. I would very much like to hear him. Regrettably, I have to be in Bloomington, Indiana to give a lecture tonight. But I always listen very carefully to what people have to say, even people who I might not necessarily agree with on issues. And I think by keeping an open mind, by reading, by listening, by visiting the area, you gain a comprehensive working knowledge. And I would emphasize that no one who speaks about the Middle East is unbiased. There is no such creature. Everyone who has an opinion has a bias. And so I think one of the key things is to identify what people's biases are when you listen to them. I am unabashedly a friend of Israel. I believe that Israel has a right to exist in peace and security within secure and recognized borders. I try to understand the Arab position, and I try to understand that it takes two to tango. In order to have a full, comprehensive peace in the Middle East, there has to be an accommodation. And the question is how to ensure Israeli security and Palestinian rights. And I must say to you, there is a bottom line in this from the Israeli perspective, and I believe from the American perspective, and that is that Palestinians have rights, but not at the expense of Israel's right to exist.
We are about midway through our conversation here with John Rothman, and we'll talk some more in a moment. We'd like you to know about upcoming programs. First of all, tomorrow morning on our show at 10 o'clock, we will get a chance to speak with Congressman Tom Ewing. He is a Republican and incumbent who... You can call and talk with him. He'll be joining us tomorrow morning at 10. As we have mentioned, we will be speaking with Abdel Salam Majali, who is head of the Jordanian delegation to the Middle East Peace Talks in Washington. He is visiting here in Champaign-Urbana. Will be with us on this program tomorrow morning at 11, so you can talk with him. Next week on the show on Monday, we'll talk about our agricultural news programming on this station. We'll have two guests with us, our own Ag News Director Charles Lindy and also Daryl Good. He's professor of agricultural economics here at the U of I. And then on Monday in hour number two, our guest will be Al Hofeld. He is a Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate here in Illinois, and we'll take your questions as well. There'll give you two more on the program Tuesday. We'll talk with Carol Mosley Braun, who is also a Democratic candidate for Senate, one of three. And then on the program Tuesday at 11, we'll speak with Andre Maroux, who is the Libertarian Party candidate for president. We thought you might be interested in hearing from him and talking with him. Those are some of the things we have coming up over the next few days. Of course, we're here weekday mornings 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you each week. One further reminder, we will have another Democratic Presidential Candidates Forum for you tonight. This is a live broadcast, and it will originate from Dallas, which Texas, of course, will be one of the most important states coming up in Super Tuesday, which is next week, the 10th. This debate will begin at 10:30 tonight. It will be hosted by ABC's Peter Jennings and will last 90 minutes. So you can hear it on this program, on this radio station, that is, tonight at 10:30. Again, I guess this morning is John Rothman. He is a lecturer, consultant, analyst on Middle East affairs and the relationship between the United States and that part of the world. If you have questions or comments, you want to be involved in our conversation, give us a call, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I'd like to talk about the relationship between Israel and the United States, which seems rather strained at the moment over the loan guarantees, which Israel has asked for, and the United States has steadfastly said, if you want us to do this, we'd be happy to do it. However, what we want you to do is freeze settlement activity in the West Bank, something that Mr. Shamir has said that he's not going to do. So, again, we've had another impasse that's been standing like this for some time. One of the questions that I'm interested in having you talk about is why you think that the United States, and I suppose we really should say President Bush, has taken such a hard line on this and made it such an issue.
I think George Bush has a notion of what is required for there to be peace in the Middle East. George Bush believes that for there to be peace, Israel must withdraw to the pre-67 borders. He believes that the Golan Heights, the West Bank and Gaza, and East Jerusalem are occupied territory, and the only way to secure peace is for Israel to withdraw from those territories. I have to tell you that the problem that I have with President Bush's perception is that while theoretically he may have a point in terms of an ideal world, the reality is that geography dictates against that kind of situation. The Israelis have been remarkably forthcoming. They've ceded land on the Golan Heights already, and I mentioned earlier the question of Quneitra. They gave away a piece of the Golan Heights to Syria on the agreement that Syria would rebuild the capital of the Golan, Quneitra, and that civilians would live there. And, of course, that was back in 75, and there's still no civilians living in Quneitra. The Israelis returned 91% of the land they took in the Six-Day War, the entire Sinai, in return for peace with Egypt. The Israelis have given land for peace. But I think for President Bush to insist on this kind of move, which would put the Arabs only 9 miles from Tel Aviv, from the seashore, is something that no government of Israel is going to accept. And I expect the impasse will continue even if Mr. Rabin wins, because Mr. Rabin is not in favor of a settlement freeze in Jerusalem, in the Golan, or in the Jordan Valley, where 90%, as I pointed out, of the settlers live. I think the president of the United States is king in foreign policy. You know, I'm always reminded when Ronald Reagan ran for president, and when he was elected, 8 years in a row in his addresses to the Congress, he advocated prayer in school. And he said, I'm for prayer in school. And the president of the United States can be for prayer in school, but a president of the United States can't order prayer in school. But in foreign policy, a president really is king. And you take a look just at the Middle East. Harry Truman's unilateral decision to recognize a newborn state of Israel over the objections of his Secretary of State George Marshall and Secretary of Defense Jim Forrestal. Eisenhower's decision in 1956 and 57 to have the Israelis withdraw from the Sinai after the Suez War, something he imposed. Richard Nixon's decision in 1973, unilaterally, to resupply Israel in the face of the massive supply of Soviet arms to the Arabs. Jimmy Carter's unilateral decision to guarantee Israel a 15-year supply of oil no matter what, following the Camp David Accords. These actions by presidents, and I'm using the Middle East, I could use any area of the world as an example, are ample demonstration of the president's supremacy. And I think for friends of Israel, there is a concern about George Bush's approach. I was profoundly disturbed by Secretary Baker's comments before the House Foreign Affairs Committee last week, because he said something was wrong. He said, we give Israel $4 billion a year, which isn't true. Part of that is grant and aid. All of that money basically comes back to the United States. For every $1 billion we spend in Israel, or we loan Israel, or grant Israel, 60,000 jobs are created in this country. But then he did something that to me was deeply offensive. He said, and now they want $10 billion in loans. That isn't what Israel's requesting. The Israelis are requesting $10 billion in loan guarantees. David, it would be like you're buying a house and asking me to sign as a guarantor on the loan. Wouldn't cost me a penny, assuming you're good for your payments. And the point is the Israelis have always paid their payments on time. I think that the characterization that Secretary Baker used was wrong. It was incorrect. It was a misstatement. And it was a deeply offensive kind of thing. In fact, the Israelis are now doing something that American foreign policy has wanted them to do for years. We in the United States advocated the right of Soviet Jews to leave the Soviet Union and come to Israel. And now the Israelis are confronted with the task of absorbing the equivalent of the United States absorbing the entire nation of France. It's a massive undertaking, and it requires assistance from the world. After all, the world encouraged the Israelis and encouraged Soviet Jews in their struggle for freedom. The United States has the legitimate right to make the request that money not be spent outside of the Green Line, that is, that money only be spent in the pre-67 borders. The Israelis have not objected to that. But to use loan guarantees as a club over the head of Israel is to me wrong. I don't believe that you use humanitarian help and assistance, and in this case, not a dime out of the American taxpayer's pocket, to hold hostage people who are fleeing from oppression. It is interesting to reflect that the entire Arab world opposed and has opposed the right of Soviet Jews to come to Israel, because they, even within Israel proper, and it is a commentary about the state of things in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But I believe that ultimately the relationship between the United States and Israel is secure. Overwhelmingly, the American people believe Israel has a right to exist. That isn't a debatable point. Even a Jesse Jackson or a Pat Buchanan, in my book, Two Sides of the Same Coin, 80% of what they say makes sense if you're a liberal or a conservative, but 20%, frankly, particularly when it comes to Jews and Israel, is deeply offensive to Jews and friends of Israel. Both of these men, no matter what they may say, on many issues, believe that Israel has a right to exist. Paul Findlay, a congressman from this state for many years, who is certainly a critic of Israel, believes Israel has a right to exist. And I think that's a broad consensus issue. And I think, therefore, that while there may be differences between the United States and Israel on individual policy, the reality is that these two nations are firmly allied. Maybe because we're both democracies, maybe because we're both aligned with a free world, maybe because we're both founded on biblical principles, maybe because we're both a nation of immigrants. There are a host of reasons that bind our two nations. And I would hasten to remind you of something else. When the Gulf War, just before the Gulf War broke out, the United States forgave a $7.1 billion debt that Egypt owed the United States. This wasn't loan guarantees. The American taxpayer forgave a $7.1 billion debt that the Egyptian government owed the United States of America. We did so because it was in our interest to do it, and I don't begrudge President Mubarak or the people of Egypt the aid which we gave them, because frankly they helped us during the Gulf War, and more than that, they are becoming a more reliable ally than we could ever have expected of Egypt 20 years ago. But I want to suggest to you that to give Israel $10 billion in loan guarantees is not a dime out of the taxpayer's pocket and works to the very best principles of American foreign policy. So I think that while there are differences and points of dispute, that in general support for Israel is very firm. And President Bush has said that repeatedly, as has Secretary Baker.
Let's talk with someone else on one of our local lines, line number one. Hello.
Hello, did you say one?
Yes, yes, go ahead.
You can hear one. This is a very plausible man, but I don't find him to be necessarily telling the whole picture. Like in terms of that not costing us a penny, I recently heard someone say that, well, it's true that that's a good loan guarantee. The money that we have to set aside money, which if you set it aside somehow costs us money because we're not using it some other way.
Let me assure you that is not correct. I would never listen to what someone else says. I would really take a look very carefully at the situation. Absolutely doesn't cost the taxpayer a dime. It's simply a guarantee. We don't have to set any money aside. Believe me, we have more than enough money in the Treasury to cover the problem.
Fine. Can I go on another point?
Yeah, please, be my guest.
When you say that this money is politically loaded, it's a political question to a great extent. And I think more than 50% of the people in the United States, and perhaps 50% of the people in Israel, feel that this not trading land for peace is quintessential to finding peace. And well, you're apologizing for Israel seems to give the impression that, like, a person cannot feel that this idea of guaranteeing loans for these more settlements, which is sort of like a de facto annexation, you can still be for Israel and against that policy. And that's how I feel about it.
No question about it. And I think Secretary Baker is saying that very clearly. He takes your position. Mm-hmm. He's saying just what you're saying. My point is that I do not believe that the million Soviet Jews who are coming out of the Soviet Union as a result of the work of many of us in the West for their freedom over many years should be jeopardized over the question of $10 billion in loan guarantees. I think the Israelis have been very clear that they are prepared not to spend a dime of that money on new settlements. By the way, they have made this very, very clear. Now, there is, of course, the argument that can be made legitimately that still the Israelis will continue the settlement policy and we're liberating funds that they may spend. Well, my answer to you very clearly is that that's what the Israeli election is all about. Israel is a vital democracy. And on June 23rd, the people of Israel are going to make a choice. And they're going to send a signal. And I think that everything, the peace talks, the loan guarantees, all of these questions are going to wait until June 23rd. I think nations that are democracies that hold these kind of elections understand, the people understand very clearly what they're voting on. And I'll tell you, there's only one democracy in the Middle East. There's only one nation that holds elections. There's only one nation that you can count on to have a good free-for-all, and that's Israel. And by gum, that's what we're going to get.
Interesting. You're a part of
rhetorician. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, we have a couple of other people. Let me just ask you one further thing, because, again, I'm curious about what you think. There was a piece, an op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times last week by Leslie Gelb.
Yes.
Which you probably saw, that where he says he thinks that the reason that the Bush administration has been so tough on loan guarantees is they're hoping that that will guarantee the defeat of Mr. Shamir, that as they continue to do that, it'll mean that Likud will lose.
No question about it. I think that the Bush administration would much prefer to deal with the Labor government. I think that this is interference, in a sense, in a domestic Israeli election. But I would remind you, and it's an interesting thought, that many years ago, Mr. Rabin endorsed Richard Nixon over George McGovern here in the States when he was the Israeli ambassador to the United States. But it's interesting to remember that when Jimmy Carter was first elected president, Rabin was prime minister of Israel. He and Rabin had a disastrous meeting at the White House prior to the Israeli elections and prior to his removal as Labor Party leader. One of the compelling reasons that Rabin lost his job, aside from a little scandal with his wife and a foreign bank account, had to do with his very bad relations with Carter. Mm-hmm. I think that, Bush would like to deal with Rabin. It may be a factor in the Israeli elections, and I think Leslie Gelb's point is well taken.
Okay, let's talk with some other people. Line two is next. Line number two. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering who owned the land that these settlements are being put on. Presumably, the land belonged to Palestinians.
Well, the presumption is incorrect, and I'll explain to you why. Most of the land that exists on the West Bank, that is the land that Israeli settlements are built on, was state-owned land. That meant that it was originally owned by the Ottoman Turks, then it was owned by the British, then it was owned by Jordan. And remember that Jordan annexed the West Bank and ruled the West Bank from 1948 or actually 1950 when annexation went into effect, until 1967. Only two nations in the world recognized that annexation. Interesting. Great Britain and Pakistan. I've never figured out why Pakistan did. The land is state-owned land, and it is interesting that when Israel has tried to confiscate land that is not state-owned land, they've been sued by Palestinians. Mind you, Palestinians who are not citizens of Israel. The cases have gone to the Israeli Supreme Court, and in every case, the Palestinians have won. It's a curious commentary on the way Israeli democracy works. So state-owned land means that the land didn't belong to anyone except the government that ruled. By the way, that's very similar to here in the United States. The overwhelming majority of land, well over 80% of the land in this country, is owned by the government. It means the government can use the land as it sees fit. And as Israel is the existing government in the territories, they are exercising that right. So that you can make another argument, which I think is a more valid argument, and that is that in order for there to be peace, there has to be an accommodation with the Palestinians. Are settlements an obstruction to peace? There are some who argue yes, some who argue no, and I believe that, as I said earlier, this election in Israel will be a referendum on the very question of these settlements and the question of land for peace.
Why am I seeing headlines in papers like the Monitor about seizures of land continuing? I didn't fully read the article, so I have to take responsibility for my ignorance. And
well, you haven't, at least I haven't seen articles about seizing of land. I've read about new settlements. I have, and I think the answer I've given you is a very precise answer, a very clear answer. I don't think anybody can dispute the answer, and that's simply the reality. I would also tell you sometimes I read headlines or articles in the newspaper that are not exactly precise. And therefore, I am skeptical, and I do try to go beyond the headlines, which is why I listen to wonderful talk shows like this, where I can hear a broad spectrum of points of view, as you hear my point of view today, and you'll have the opportunity to hear a counterbalance to it tomorrow at 11 o'clock when the Jordanian representative is here.
I also read Father Elias Shakur's book, Blood Brothers.
So have I. Excellent book. He wrote another one, by the way, more recently. A very good book as well.
But he was he is somebody who advocates peace, but is also a victim of Israeli expansionism, and his own village was his village was vacated at the request of the army.
That's correct. In 1948,
when they were not allowed back into the village, they applied to the courts. The courts came down the villagers' side. The army came in and blew up the village.
Yeah, let me explain to you, that village, of course, is on the Lebanese border. Has been a target, or would have been a target under any circumstances. There happens to be a real dispute in Israel over Mr. Shakur's point of view. I want to make a comment, though, about a word you used that intrigued me. And the word was Israeli expansionism. And I highlight the word because it is a term that I think needs to be understood. If Israel were expansionist, it would not have returned 91% of the land that it took in the Six-Day War, nor would it be engaged in talks which may result in land for peace. I think rather than using the term expansionism, I think you have to understand that the Israelis are highly security conscious. They live in a very, very small area. And, in fact, the Israelis have demonstrated repeatedly over the years that they are prepared to give land for peace, but they pose a question. What land, for what peace, and to whom? Imagine, as I said earlier, if Yasser Arafat had a state on the West Bank during the Gulf War. Arafat is a man who supported Saddam Hussein, who called for the use of biological and chemical weapons against the Israelis. There is real concern, and I think that one has to take into context that when you use a term like Israeli expansionism, that it is a pejorative term which needs to be understood in a proper context. The Israelis have given land for peace. They're prepared to make compromise, but not compromise which puts their very existence in jeopardy.
I apologize for use of the word. I couldn't come up with a better one on the spur of the moment.
That's all right. No problem. You're on the radio, after all.
Not being attuned to the proper language to use in this discussion, it's sometimes hard to come up with a good term.
But I think it is. Precision is very important because misuse of words sometimes creates misunderstanding, and I'm very glad to be able to work with you to clarify that thought.
But part of my concern is seeing... I was reading the Chalice and the Blade, the discussion of patriarchy, and it was pointing out, among other things, just a small part of the book, about the original movement of the Israelites into Canaan. It was something that bothered me, and I was a real small child, and I had this golden Bible book and with beautiful pictures my life looking through, and I thought, weren't there people there before the Israelis moved in? And there were the references in this book and what happened to the people who were there. The men were all killed, all the adults were killed, the virgin girls were saved, and they were numbered along with the cattle and the sheep and the donkeys for use by the soldiers. And it just bothers me to think that there is a possibility that people who, and I think that there is some evidence that there are people who have lived there for a long time whose property is being confiscated. It's not just government on land.
Let me just say to you, I understand your point of view. I do want to tell you, if you read the Bible, you will find there are two interpretations. One is the interpretation you've given, but if you read the book of Joshua, you'll also see that there is reference to the peaceful occupation of the land. Perhaps it means that there were two different writers with different interpretations. But I want to suggest that to apply the Bible to what happens today is not something that I normally do. I don't believe it's applicable. I think most Israelis view it purely from the point of security. And I would point out to you something that's very significant. That 18% of the population of Israel are non-Jews. They are people who live within the Green Line. They are citizens of Israel. They include Muslims and Christians, and they live in the country. And I would suggest to you there are 1.5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza, whose future has to be negotiated. They aren't going away, and the Israelis aren't going away. There have been injustices created on both sides. What has to happen now is to be able to get two sides, both of whom have rights, to come together to try to reach a solution. I would be the last person in the world to tell you that anyone has complete right on their side. But I would suggest that those who criticize Israel repeatedly and dogmatically, that sometimes the underlying current really is Israel doesn't have a right to exist. And I know you join me in saying that, of course, Israel has a right to exist. And the question is, how do you achieve justice and equality and peace for all the people in the area?
I hope the caller will forgive me because we just have about 5 minutes left and the lines are full. And we won't be able to get in everybody who is waiting. And my apologies to them. I want to try to get at least one more, possibly two calls before we have to finish. We'll go to our toll-free line next. Hello.
Hello, sir. I to tell you where I'm coming from. I cheered as I watched on TV the representative from Florida. What was his name?
Larry Smith.
Larry, yes, Larry Smith. I cheered as he gave the cynical James A. Baker what for. It's about time somebody got after these guys. I'm not Jewish, but I respect Israel. I'm inspired by their nation and their will and their energy and their intelligence. And sir, way back when George Bush first announced this question of withholding this guarantee, I think it was back last summer. That far back?
In September, right?
When was it?
In September.
Yes, sir. It was still summer, I think. And you indicated that this was some of his real politics. I submit, sir, that it was a question of wanting to get reelected. It was a cynical, utterly cynical move, designed to get more. He felt he could get more votes from bigoted non-Jews in this country than he could from Jews. And I felt that your comments on that were slightly disingenuous, or maybe a little bit too. Kind for my thinking, but
well, we take your point. We don't have a lot of time.
Change now, sir. That the reason Bush is doing this now is so that he can influence get Rabin elected. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I think there is a real point there. It's very possible if that's one of his goals. But I think that George Bush has a real commitment, as I explained earlier. And I appreciate very much your comments, sir.
Do you see this or not see this as an attempt to play to anti-Jewish sentiment in the United States?
I think that George Bush had a genuine shock last year when the White House switchboard lit up and all the closet anti-Semites climbed out of the walls to call him. And if you know, he sent a letter to Shoshana Carden, the president of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, apologizing for any inference, because I think George Bush has a foreign policy approach. I think we have our share of bigots in this country who will seize on this kind of an issue, and I hope George Bush learned his lesson.
We'll grab one more caller real quick. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, the conference on the peace talks, I think, will be futile until they come to an agreement on allocating water rights. Israel is now drawing the major water aquifer, which lies underneath the West Bank. They don't want to lose control of this. The Palestinians have had the access to this water, but they've had it curtailed, and they want that access back again. Now, Israel also is interested in Lebanon for the same reason, water.
Well, let me just answer you, ma'am, by saying that there's only one nation in the Middle East which refused to come to talks relating to water, and that was the Syrians. That if there is going to be peace in the Middle East, the Syrians have to be a part of this. And there's no doubt in my mind that the question of the water which flows in the Jordan River, meaning from the Golan Heights, from the Don on the Banias, is what's really critical. The Palestinians have concerns about water. There is no question about it. Those issues have to be addressed in the peace conference. And I believe that it would be very constructive if the Syrians would join the Palestinians in discussions on these regional issues. I think that's the only way to make progress. Believe me, the water on the West Bank is nothing compared to the water that's affected by the Jordan River. And I might add, if you travel in the area as I have, no one is without water, and no one is unable to drink or to fertilize or to take care of their land. That's not the issue. And I think that we've got to address the regional issues, and I hope that as the peace talks reconvene after June 23rd, that these regional questions will be addressed.
Okay, well, I think that there's where we'll have to leave it, because here we're at the end of the time. I want to thank you very much.
As always, an absolute delight, and I can only say that I hope when next I'm here, rather than conflict and war, that we are going to have real peace. And I am only sorry I'm not going to be able to listen at 11 o'clock tomorrow to your broadcast with a Jordanian representative, but I want to thank you, David. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you very much. John Rothman is a political and foreign policy consultant specializing in the Middle East, among other things. And for people in Bloomington, Indiana, he's going to be there tonight.
I'm speaking there tonight, and if you call the local Hillel, they will be able to tell you where. Can I pick this up in Bloomington?
Yeah, I think so.
Then you know what? I'm going to try to listen tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Thanks, David.
Anna Flanagan is up next. She's the host of our afternoon magazine, and she will be with you for the rest of the afternoon. What will you be doing at 1 today?
Well, today we'll be joined by Thomas Lazell. He's the chancellor of the Board of Governors system here in Illinois. And on Monday, we had talked with State Representative